Chapter 32, Operation Curdle. Frankly, being civil with Mitch isn't always so easy. The fact is that his campaign of obstruction wasn't just obnoxious. It was deeply cynical, and ultimately proved to be downright dangerous. During his presidential campaign, Barack Obama had offered a refreshing and even inspirational vision of what our democracy could be. "We needn't be trapped by our old partisan divides," he told Americans. "We can change the tone in Washington. We can set aside our differences and recognize our common humanity. The cynics be damned. We should dare to hope for something better from our politics." "On this day," he declared in his inaugural address, "we gather because we have chosen hope over fear, unity of purpose over conflict and discord. On this day, we come to proclaim an end to the petty grievances and false promises, the recriminations and worn-out dogmas that for far too long have strangled our politics." To which Mitch McConnell basically responded, "Oh yeah, well screw you, buddy." Even before the inauguration, Republicans had decided that they were going to prevent the new president from keeping his promise to move the country beyond the rank partisanship that had consumed Washington. McConnell had laid out the strategy to his caucus at a resort in West Virginia that winter. Instead of working with the popular new president to pass his agenda or trying to find areas of compromise, Senate Republicans would focus on making the new president less popular. Journalist Alec McGillis, who reported on the summit in his book, The Cynic, The Political Education of Mitch McConnell, summed it up this way. In other words, wait out Americans' hopefulness in a dire moment for the country until it curdles to disillusionment. The way I see it, Republicans had three options for how to deal with the new political reality they faced in January 2009. Option one, recognize that the new president was hugely popular and had a mandate from the American people to deal with a series of pressing crises and ask, how can we help? Option two, recognize that the new president was hugely popular and had a mandate from the American people to deal with a series of pressing crises and say, congratulations, but we have some political standing too, and we're going to make you come to the table and negotiate, so let's sit down and work out something we can all live with. Option three, focus on reducing his popularity, refuse to respect his mandate, and as for those pressing crises, not only are we not going to help him solve them, we're going to do everything we can to prevent him from solving them, and then we're going to blame him for failing to solve them. In fact, after a while, we're going to start blaming him for creating the problems in the first place. Democrats and Republicans had faced this dilemma many times before, but never before had anyone ever chosen door number three. In part, Republicans were able to get away with Operation Curdle because of timing. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt took office in 1933, the country had been suffering with the Great Depression for almost 4 years. The message from the American people to the new president was loud and clear and universal. Do something, anything. Standing in his way would have been an act of political suicide. Even option two would have taken some real chutzpah. President Obama, on the other hand, took office just as the economic meltdown was beginning to peak. The day he took the oath of office, George W. Bush shook his hand saying, "The economy is losing 800,000 jobs a month, stock markets in free fall, the foreclosure crisis is out of control, businesses are closing their doors across the country, I'm going home to Texas. Good luck." Then he left, only to pop his head back in. "Oh, and there's still war going on? Maybe a couple, not sure." Then he headed for the helicopter. "Oh, hey," he shouted over the roar of the propellers. "That Bin Laden guy? Never gonna find him. Anyway, I'm out of here." Then he and Laura flew away, waving goodbye to an economy he had left in ruins. The timing mattered not just because the most devastating effects of recession caused by Bush's policies were about to be felt under Obama's watch, but because the delay and the impact of the recession gave Republicans just enough wiggle room to play politics with it. Of course, while ordinary Americans were just beginning to realize how bad things were getting, economists had already issued dire warnings that, if dramatic action wasn't taken, the Great Recession could turn into another Great Depression. The numbers were scary, and the solution was clear, an emergency stimulus package that could put people back to work quickly, build shovel-ready infrastructure projects, and rescue state and local governments that were shedding teachers and other workers who were delivering desperately needed services. Economists agreed that, in order to be effective, this stimulus would need to be massive, at least $1 trillion. But political scientists agreed that Democrats had only 59 votes, and one of those votes, me, was at the time stuck in recount hell, which meant that in order to get the 60 votes necessary to break Mitch McConnell's filibuster and proceed to an actual vote on the stimulus, President Obama would need two Republicans. Desperate to find just two Republicans willing to help him save the economy, President Obama had to make compromise after compromise, eventually reducing the total package to $787 billion. On top of that, a couple hundred billion was diverted away from the direct spending economists were calling for and instead used to cut taxes for individuals and businesses. That's what it took to get Arlen Specter, who would soon defect to the Democratic caucus, and Maine's two moderate senators, Olympia Snow and Susan Collins, on board. Thanks to those three and not one other Republican, the stimulus package barely broke Mitch McConnell's filibuster and passed in the Senate over the hysterical denunciations of the rest of the Republican caucus. And then, when it went to the House, Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats had to pass it all by themselves. It received not one single Republican vote, which Republicans celebrated like they just won the Super Bowl. A few of them even lit a cop car on fire. And then, having enjoyed making a big show out of refusing to help the president succeed, Republicans then turned to making a big show out of complaining that he had failed. In reality, he hadn't. The stimulus kept us from falling into another Great Depression and created millions of jobs. But it took a while to kick in, and it wasn't as strong as President Obama and Democrats wanted, or as economists had called for. It's hard to get people excited about avoiding a hypothetical depression when you're slowly muddling through a huge recession. The economy didn't feel stimulated, so it was very easy for Republicans to win the messaging fight. At a caucus meeting months later, Harry Reid reminded us Democrats that the stimulus had included the biggest middle-class tax cut in history. True. Sherrod Brown leaned over to me and grumbled sarcastically, "Yeah, I get thanked for that every day." People had no idea, because while the Bush administration had celebrated its 2001 tax cut by mailing taxpayers a letter at taxpayer expense announcing it, this time Americans simply had a little less withheld in every paycheck. Meanwhile, the construction jobs, the infrastructure upgrades, the shovel-ready projects all across the country, well, the Obama administration put up signs at all these sites. But the signs read, "Funded by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act." The what? Democrats have always had a disadvantage in messaging. Not because we're idiots, but because we have complex ideas and sometimes a hard time explaining them succinctly. Our bumper stickers always end with, "Continued on next bumper sticker." And by the time I got to the Senate in July, Republicans were giddily and successfully blaming the still sluggish economy on Obama's failed stimulus, which didn't stop them from simultaneously taking credit for stimulus projects in their districts, grinning widely for photos at groundbreakings and later ribbon cuttings. Not long after I got into office, I went to a groundbreaking ceremony in Maple Grove for a 3-mile, $47 million extension of Minnesota State Highway 610, made possible by an infusion of $27 million in stimulus funds. There were about a dozen public officials there, a few state legislators, a mayor or two, some county commissioners, and Senator Klobuchar and me. I was surprised to see Minnesota's 3rd District Republican Congressman Eric Paulson, who, like every House Republican, had voted against the stimulus, smiling under his hard hat. When I got up to speak, I said, "Well, I certainly don't deserve any credit for this. I got to the Senate after the stimulus was passed. I guess we should thank the members of Congress here who voted for the stimulus." I looked down the line of hard hats and said, "Okay, there's Amy Klobuchar. Let's hear it for Amy." Applause. "And let's see," I continued, looking directly at Representative Paulson, "well, I guess just Amy." Meanwhile, presiding over the Senate, I heard Republican senators claim that the only jobs created by the stimulus had been for federal bureaucrats. Presumably, these included federal bureaucrats who had moved to Minnesota to operate the excavators, bulldozers, compactors, and pavers to build the 3-mile extension of Highway 610. The stimulus had been a successful test run of the Republican strategy: abdicate their responsibility to govern, obstruct the president's agenda, complain that things weren't getting better, and wait for Americans to get fed up so they could profit politically at his expense. Operation Kirtle was well underway, and any notion of building a better politics, any hope of changing the tone in Washington, was quickly erased. Soon after I walked into this mess, I asked a few of my veteran colleagues if it had ever been this bad. "Sure," a couple of them said. "Remember that guy who almost got caned to death on the Senate floor? Charles Sumner?" "Yeah, that guy." So the one time that anyone could think of when it was this bad was the near fatal beating of a sitting senator in the lead up to the Civil War and the deaths of more than 600,000 Americans. But then again, that was the summer of 2009. It actually got worse from there. That September, a South Carolina Republican congressman named Joe Wilson interrupted President Obama during an address to a joint session of Congress, shouting, "You lie!" It was a pretty shocking breach of protocol, but over the next 4 days, Wilson took in $1 million in campaign donations. Stuff like this was already becoming par for the course. Republicans had already decided to disregard President Obama's mandate, and some were even going so far as to question his legitimacy. After listening to one too many examples of a sitting congressman fanning the flames of the birther myth, I told Drew that I wanted the Capitol Police to install a special metal detector before the State of the Union address for any member of Congress who didn't believe the president was born in the United States. Drew thought I was joking. I was, I think. But I made a serious case. If you believe that Obama wasn't born in Hawaii, I reasoned, it meant two things. One, you were generally insane. And two, you believe that the president was a usurper. Exactly the sort of people who should get wanded before being allowed into a room with a guy. "You can't do that," said Drew. "Okay," I said, "but if one of these guys plugs the president, you're going to feel pretty stupid." Republicans made huge gains in the 2010 midterms, seizing the majority in the House and picking up 6 seats in the Senate. Worse, these gains were powered and the new House majority controlled by the ascendant Tea Party. These folks weren't just extremely conservative. They were openly uninterested in actual governing. They saw themselves not as legislators, but as revolutionaries. More than a few of them were just plain nuts. All year they've been raising hell at town hall meetings, complaining about everything from the Affordable Care Act, more about this in a bit, to the president's secret Muslim heritage, more about this, I'm guessing, in Donald Trump's presidential memoir. Now they had come to Washington, and what's more, they were clearly running the show. At the 2011 State of the Union, I walked in with Rand Paul, the libertarian new senator from Kentucky, who had chosen me to be his mentor. Let me explain. After the 2010 election, I called all the winners on election night to congratulate them and welcome them to the Senate, even the Republicans. I thought that was what you do. It isn't. I guess I was the only Democrat who called Rand, and we had a nice conversation. So Rand picked me to be his Democratic mentor. He picked Texas Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson for his Republican. I hadn't even been aware that there was a mentor program because I had been seated so late. Long and short of it, I was a terrible mentor. I advised Rand to be a workhorse and not a show horse, not realizing that he was planning to run for president at the first opportunity. Every once in a while, I'd ask Kay, "Is he listening to any of your advice?" "No," she'd say, slightly puzzled. So we walk into the House chamber, and I gave Rand some mentorly advice. "Rand, if the president says something you don't like, your job is to stand up and yell, 'You lie.'" Rand laughed and then added, "Actually, you know, that would be pretty good for fundraising." The chamber was crowded, and I had to scramble to find a seat, winding up next to Marco Rubio, another new Republican senator. I tried my joke again. "Marco, some advice. If the president says something you disagree with, get up and yell, 'You lie.'" Chuckling, Marco responded, "That'd be great for fundraising." I turned to my other side and poked Saxby Chambliss, a veteran Republican. "Saxby," I said, "I just told Marco that if the president says something he doesn't like, he should get up and yell, 'You lie.'" Saxby laughed and said, "Not a bad fundraising tactic." The message had clearly gotten through to Republicans, even the non-crazy ones. Not only were they not being punished for the strategy they'd embarked upon at the beginning of President Obama's term, but they were being rewarded for it by a conservative base hell-bent on destroying the guy. And so, instead of trying to tamp down the most extreme elements of their party, Republicans indulged them time and time again, sometimes even egging them on by promising victories that they knew were impossible, just to keep them on board and engaged. This dynamic manifested itself in years of ugly brinksmanship. For example, raising the debt ceiling had always been relatively routine, but with the Tea Party pulling House Speaker John Boehner's strings, it became an opportunity to take the fiscal future of the country hostage. "Sign Paul Ryan's radical austerity budget into law," they threatened, "or we'll force America to default on its debt for the first time ever." That's what these guys were about. As my friend Norm Ornstein, the guy who played Norm Ornstein for Indecision 92, and his less funny colleague Tom Mann would later write in their book, "It's Even Worse Than It Looks," this new Republican Party was, quote, "an insurgent outlier, ideologically extreme, contemptuous of the inherited social and economic policy regime, scornful of compromise, unpersuaded by conventional understanding of facts, evidence, and science, and dismissive of the legitimacy of its political opposition." Even after they failed to defeat President Obama in 2012, Republicans had gone too far down this path to turn back. They had trained their base to respect nothing and to expect everything. While the GOP's official post-election autopsy urged moderation on issues like immigration, the activists who ran the show concluded that Mitt Romney had lost because he wasn't extreme enough. By the end of President Obama's second term, Republicans had failed to keep any of the promises they had made to keep the Tea Partiers on board and engaged. They hadn't repealed health care reform or defunded Planned Parenthood or proved that the president was born in Kenya. All they had done was break the damn government. With Republicans putting up a unified front of opposition, we made no real progress on big issues like immigration or tax reform. Even after the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, we couldn't get an extremely mild gun safety bill through the Senate. And, of course, they shut down the government for 16 days in 2013, costing the U.S. economy $24 billion. And the thing of it was, ordinary Americans who weren't themselves rabid partisans saw all this happening and blamed both sides. I was always amazed when I would go around Minnesota and meet people who didn't follow national politics that closely, but who knew that Republicans had been extremely uncooperative during the Obama administration. "I know," I'd say, "it's awful." "Yeah," these people would often respond, "but that's Washington for you." I never fully understood this a pox on both houses mentality until I read an article by Jonathan Rauch in The Atlantic last summer. He was talking about a study by a pair of political scientists in which they found that between 25 and 40% of Americans have a severely distorted view of how government and politics are supposed to work. Rauch calls these people politophobes. They see the contentious give and take of politics as unnecessary and distasteful. Specifically, they believe that obvious, common sense solutions to the country's problems are out there for the plucking. The reason these obvious solutions are not enacted is that politicians are corrupt or self-interested or addicted to unnecessary partisan feuding. These folks didn't reach that conclusion without some help. Many political reporters can't seem to write a sentence about a problem without casting at least some blame onto both sides. Congressional Republicans knew that and made hay with it. McConnell and his friends consistently blamed Obama for the partisanship of the Obama years, managing to suppress their giggles all the while. And too many journalists bought it. Take, for example, this blood-curdling artifact of Operation Curdle, a piece in Time magazine by Mark Halperin from December 2009, identifying the root cause of Obama-era partisan rancor. Once the new president cast his lot with his party in passing an economic stimulus measure rather than seeking bipartisan agreement, rival Republicans started digging in. Fortunately, the press cleaned up its act before 2016. Speaking of which, as the 2016 presidential campaign unfolded, and it became clear that Donald Trump might actually become the Republican nominee, pundits searched their pundit brains for answers to where the Trump phenomenon had come from, pinning the blame on everyone from Sarah Palin to Richard Nixon to Kim Kardashian. But the answer was right there in front of us the whole time. Yes, Donald Trump's takeover of the Republican Party had roots in the fact-free, right-wing media bubble and in Newt Gingrich's pioneering of the politics of personal destruction in the 1990s. But his campaign grew directly out of the strategy Mitch McConnell implemented beginning at that retreat in West Virginia after Barack Obama won the White House in 2008. A strategy of total war against a Democratic president. A strategy in which no attack, no matter how false or outrageous, was out of bounds. When Republicans chose door number three, when they chose to become insurgent outliers, they unwittingly opened the door for Donald Trump. For the fat cat donors, special interest lobbyists, and elected officials who usually run the Republican show, wrote David Corn of Mother Jones, Trump is an invasive species. But he has grown large and strong in the manure they have spread across the political landscape. And after 8 years of refusing to help the president govern, in fact, 8 years of actively trying to make the country ungovernable, Republicans hadn't just created a monster within their own ranks. All that inaction and gridlock helped to create a nation of politophobes, people who correctly felt they were being left behind in the economy and correctly felt that the political system was broken and rigged against people like them, and extremely incorrectly felt that everyone who had anything to do with politics was more or less equally to blame. Rauch writes that these voters are inclined towards leaders who will step forward, cast aside cowardly politicians and venal special interests, and implement long overdue solutions. These leaders can be politicians, technocrats, or autocrats, whatever works, Rauch adds. Whether the process is democratic is not particularly important.